So this afternoon I'd like to speak about equanimity as a refuge, as a place to gather one's strength, even for a moment. It doesn't mean that we don't do anything about what needs to be done or needs to be said, but it's a moment where we can gather one's strength, or it might be a few years, as someone was just mentioning, or it could be, you know, a day or a week. From that place that we can gather our strength, we can gather our wisdom, gather our compassion, so that we can act from that place. It said that equanimity is the very powerful factor that allows the compassionate action to come forth, and to come forth with wisdom. Because if we don't wait and notice what's going on in our hearts, in our minds, and wait for the time when it's clear of aversion or attachment, or relatively clear, then we act from our old habit patterns. We speak from our old habit patterns. We don't give enough time for wisdom to come in, for true connecting compassion to come in. There was a time when I heard the Dalai Lama speak to a group of activists, and one activist was getting very enthusiastic and on, you know, kind of more in the realm of reactive about the situation in the mother country of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And he wanted to do everything he could, of course, to help, but it was with that, you know, with kind of aversion and fear and attachment to needing it to be a certain way. And His Holiness said to this person to just wait. Wait till his mind is more settled. Wait till there's more equanimity. Because it's from that equanimity, it's the leading forward of that equanimity that compassion follows behind that. We live in this constant uncertainty when we look at our lives realistically. Birth and death, joy and sorrow, pain, gain, fame and disrepute. And then we have in between, there's aging, there's sickness, all of that. This is the realm of our existence, and we don't know what will be around the corner. We don't know what's over the next threshold, even when we may think we're taking a step into something that's wonderful, but it doesn't turn out that way. We live with the fact of change. We live with the fact of uncertainty. And that's why when the Buddha set the wheel rolling of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, he started out with a discourse on the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is the truth of suffering. This is how it is in this world. Suffering includes uncertainty, not knowing how it's going to be. It includes the fact of change, of course. We live with reactivity to all this all the time. If we're wise and there can be some inclining of the mind towards equanimity, perhaps there's some genuine compassion that can come up for ourselves because we are living with this uncertainty, because we're living with so much change. Perhaps we can live with a balanced mind, or at least know how to incline it there when it's not so balanced. So this is what we're learning to do in our practice. It's easy for us to forget that part of being human is experiencing all of these vicissitudes, the gain and loss, praise and blame, etc., joy and sorrow. There's a prayer from Mother Teresa. I come from a Catholic background, so all of these words are very precious to me, and also I can understand where they're coming from. She uses the words in this prayer, "Deliver me, O Jesus." And if you're not there in your connection and understanding, it could be about delivering oneself, you know, with equanimity. And she says, "Deliver me, O Jesus, from the desire of being loved, from the desire of being extolled, from the desire of being honored, from the desire of being praised, from the desire of being preferred, from the desire of being consulted, from the desire of being approved, from the desire of being popular." There is so much of that. It's not just being contented. There's so much desire in our minds, in our hearts. This is part of being human. Also part of being human is fear, which is part of hatred or aversion. And so the prayer goes, "Deliver me from the fear of being humiliated, from the fear of being despised, from the fear of suffering rebukes, from the fear of being forgotten, from the fear of being wronged, from the fear of being slandered, from the fear of being ridiculed, from the fear of being suspected." We all live with this. It doesn't matter if, you know, you're the Buddha or you're Jesus or Muhammad or a simple person like myself or you. We see that when we practice equanimity, we can maybe for a moment be free of that fear, be free of that kind of strong wanting that doesn't allow us to see clearly. It takes a large measure of equanimity to live in this world full of those ups and downs, full of those ways of being that are part of our lives. To do our practice on retreat, we open to a lot of vulnerability in our hearts. And it's not easy to do this, to just be quiet and see what's stirring in our mind and heart. To remain balanced as we navigate the outer terrain, to remain balanced as we navigate the terrain of our family, our job, our social world, our global responsibilities, to remain balanced as we look in our own hearts and see what's going on there. This is not very easy. And so we need some fundamental basic understandings, a place where we can bring some practice and use it as a kind of foundational requirement of living. I came across these words, and I've used them a little bit during our time together. To see the world with quiet eyes. When I first heard those words, they really spoke to me because it wasn't just about, you know, seeing as an outer event, but just being able to tune into what's the inner event? How does this heart and mind see the world with quiet eyes? Is it quiet inside so that it can be quiet outside also? The words really spoke to that subjective experience of equanimity when we're more practiced with it. Whenever I felt the presence of equanimity, and it's a growing presence, it's a growing depth, it's a growing strength. Every time I practice, I feel it more and more deeply, more and more strongly, more and more currently. I feel within me, or I see more clearly in others, when there is a seeing the world with quiet eyes. It's not so easy to do that in this swift world. There are many opportunities to react and to notice painfully how we react out of deeply conditioned and ingrained patterns of greed, hatred, and confusion. It takes a lot of courage to go inside and to see that. To see that we may not be responding to the world in the appropriate ways, but we're reacting. We're not coming from an inner quiet, but from an inner busyness, confusion, doubt, attachment, aversion. So these words, to see the world with quiet eyes, have been a refuge and a strength to me. They were spoken by the Reverend Howard Thurman, an African-American who co-founded and co-pastored the first international and interdenominational cultural church for the Fellowship of All Peoples in San Francisco. So I just wanted to read this. This was part of his collection of meditations entitled Deep is the Hunger. And he asks the question here, how may one work in the world courageously and intelligently on behalf of a decent world without despair, without complete fatigue? What are the resources for personal rehabilitation and renewal? That we may be able to look out on life with all its cruel vicissitudes and transcendent joys, with quiet eyes and a tranquil spirit. I think we come to practice because we're trying to answer this question all the time. And maybe we pick up here and there, oh, this is how I can handle it. This is what I can bring into my heart and therefore bring into the world. It's a question that we'll be constantly answering forever on our path for inner freedom. And as I engage in the various facets of my own life and the practices that I do, I ask myself this question over and over. Am I seeing the world with quiet eyes? Or am I straining to see, to understand, to try to do something, to fix something? Can I just relax back and just receive this moment as it is to help me discern what's really going on the outer world, on the inner world? It helps me discern if I'm drawing on unhealthy patterns to respond or that I'm reacting from because I'm not aware of them. It helps me to know when there is an absence of those patterns or the energy is not has not fallen into those pathways of the mind and is now in another pathway that it can truly respond with some genuine kindness and care, connection to an outer situation. It takes the strength of equanimity to do this. It's a powerful practice. Of all the practices of the Brahmaviharas, it's said that equanimity is the king or the queen of them, the highest of them all. Because when we've done everything we can to offer metta to others and to ourselves, or to offer the metta that is compassion, which is taking our kindness and turning it towards suffering very specifically, that's compassion. When something is joyful, to offer our sympathetic joy. When we've done whatever's appropriate and all we can for that situation, we've responded with wisdom or any one of the Brahmaviharas, and we know that we can't do any more, at least for that moment, then we can fall back on equanimity. And equanimity says, this is how it is right now, as we've all been practicing. This moment is a result of mysterious moments, causes and conditions that have been put into action, into the karmic stream, and have unfolded into this particular situation, experience. We may not know what all of those are, and they're not personal. There's no one to blame. We're not at fault. That's important to remember. Mysterious actions, causes, and conditions unfold. So in a down-to-earth way, equanimity means not being thrown off balance by events that have already happened. They're out of our control simply because they've already happened. We may have some influence over how we can guide or influence the course of events in the future. But what has already happened, we have no control over. The emotion that's come up in our minds, it's already happened. We may have some way to incline the mind towards some other way that it can respond to the moment. But what's already happened, that's what we say to, this is how it is right now. Or maybe we're still feeling it. An event that's happened in the outer conditions of the world, it's already happened. We don't have any control over that. We do what we can, but having attachment to the result of what we do will only cause suffering. So, not being thrown off balance by events beyond our control, and knowing that whatever we do may have a great influence, but still, thinking that we have control over the result of our actions, we really don't. There are countless causes and conditions that come together with our one action, with our one, what we say, what we do. It's totally mysterious. The Buddha said that if you try to understand karma, your head would explode, or something like that. It's one of those imponderables. So just to understand karma, it's the law of cause and effect. And it's not just cause, it's the many conditions. We don't have control over what those conditions will be that arise, that come together with our own intention. We still fulfill our good intentions, but we don't have any control over the outcome. So we don't rush into a reaction when we know that when we see deeply within ourselves that there's this compulsion to get even. When we know ourselves well, we don't respond when there's some judgment or opinion or criticism about that person or situation or individual. Discernment, yes, but when there's some kind of aversion coming from judging, criticizing, we just wait a while until that calms down, try to develop some equanimity. One way that one of my colleagues translates upekka, which is the word for equanimity, upekka, he translates it as standing at the center to see without being caught by what is seen or heard. And when you stand at the center, you can see all sides and don't have to just react right away. You can take in what needs to be taken in and then discern what needs to be done instead of reacting. We stay grounded in the power of taking time to just observe. And from that, the power for equanimity to just accept this is what's going on right now. And from the power of intention, we don't know if it will happen, but the power of intention to incline the mind towards equanimity as much as we can. And then from that place to do what we can do if something is to be done. In the Dhammapada, a collection of verses by the Buddha, there is a metaphor of a rock, and there's lots of metaphors used for this practice, for this state, for this experience of equanimity. And this one is, as a solid mass of rock is not stirred by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise or blame, by joy or sorrow, by gain or loss, etc. So this is really staying grounded in that power, in that, somebody said, a feeling of gravity, a feeling of really being centered in the earth, on the earth. It's hard to do because it's hard to be still when we feel that energy of reactivity. And that's why we have to practice more with it. Sometimes the metaphor is as a noble mountain with a huge base, a very wide base, that has this steadiness, this balance, this stability. The mountain that I live on, Haleakala, it comprises actually more than half of the whole island of Maui. And looking out of my kitchen window, I can see a lot of it. The flanks, we live on about the 2,000-foot level, and I see just one side of it, and the other as far as I can see, but there's much more to see. And it always gives me that kind of connection of, oh, that's how the heart can be. That's how this mind can be. A feeling of very steady balance. In fact, the function of equanimity is said to be steadiness. Sometimes it's described as an evenness of mind, a steadiness of mind and heart. Another metaphor is of the sky or space, which can contain anything, dark or light, feathers or metal, birds or airplanes, heat or cold. It doesn't reject anything that comes into its space. Equanimity has that spaciousness which can contain all the diversities and dualities of this world. When we see our minds and hearts go through places and experiences where we're rejecting, where we're discriminating, where we're leaving out anyone, any individual or any person, any group of persons, then we know that our minds really need to get bigger to just hold everything that there is in this world. It's not that we just want to hold what's pleasant to us. True equanimity is infused with loving kindness. All of the Brahma-viharas have to start out with loving-kindness. That's its base. So it's not this kind of dull and empty feeling that we're not really connected, or we don't feel our softness in our hearts, our gentleness. With equanimity, we can feel that genuine caring. It may not be at the forefront. What's more at the forefront is a sense of balance, sense of spaciousness. But it's definitely there. It empowers loving kindness to offer unconditional friendliness to all beings. That's why loving kindness is said to be able, have this ability to offer its goodwill, offer the goodwill to all beings, not just to the benefactor, to oneself, to a dear friend, but also to a neutral person, also to the persons we don't like or we feel that we don't want to be connected to. Even when we're distanced from them, we can still offer them loving kindness. And sometimes that's how we develop it the most, when there is some distance and we have that chance to offer loving kindness. When I was just recently at the monastery in Burma, we chant this long loving-kindness chant. And it isn't like the one that some of you are used to chanting. It's a very different one. Actually, we chant it in Burmese. It's kind of interesting for me, but I've gotten used to it over these years. And it doesn't just go from oneself to the benefactor to, you know, those five individuals. It really specifies very particular groups of people and individuals, like, for example, to all of our benefactors of this monastery, to the benefactors of all monasteries, to the celestial beings, the guardians of the monastery in the land, even to those beings we don't maybe believe in or we don't understand, what, you know, celestial beings, devas, or like that, which I do happen to believe in. But sometimes it's just being able to open to the mystery of that and say, okay, even beings I don't see, can I offer loving kindness to them? Offering loving kindness to all the teachers, of course, of this monastery, and all the bhikkhus, the monks, all the nuns. And then it goes on and on, very particular, not to particular like Seda Upandita, but to, you know, those classifications. And then it got to the place to offering loving kindness to all the thieves and bandits of the community. And I noticed when we got to that, you know, I didn't want to say it to all the thieves and bandits. And of course, with wisdom, I know that they need loving kindness too. And of course, deep in my heart, I would want to. But just noticing my heart close down around it, just momentarily. So offering to all, this is what equanimity empowers loving kindness to do. So we usually hear the word equanimity and think that it's just about balance, but it's also about spaciousness, also about opening to all without discrimination, without leaving anyone out. That's its strength. It said that equanimity is love that can encompass everything, yet possess nothing. Doesn't have to hold on to whatever it encompasses. Our dear friends, our loved ones, can offer love without holding on to them, without feeling that it needs to be a certain way for them in order for us to love them. We all see this quality of big-heartedness when we care for someone so unconditionally that even when something comes up between oneself and another, even when a difficult side of them is exposed, and even when that difficulty or anger is directed towards us, somehow, even though it's trying, we can still keep our heart open to them. That's the spaciousness of equanimity that's working there. That's what makes loving kindness unconditional, actually, is that kind of spaciousness of equanimity. One time someone came into our home when Manindra was there, and Manindra had been recovering from some surgery, and he was just very quietly being in his room the whole time. He was there for a few months. And he didn't go outside much, so not many people knew he was there. We also had this thief in the neighborhood. And he was a young boy, a little bit troubled, and he would come in to people's homes. We heard about him from other neighbors. And he would actually try to steal medicine from the cabinets. And so one day he came into our home, and Manindra was there and heard something going on in the bathroom. And so he came out while this young man was just kind of in the hallway, maybe leaving or maybe going towards looking more what's going on, what's happening in the bedrooms. And upon seeing Manindra, dressed in white, you know, with kind of a luminous face and head, he thought that Manindra was a ghost, maybe, because people thought we had ghosts in our house, actually. And the young man, according to Manindra, screamed, "Ah!" And he ran away. Manindra told us all this in detail later. And so he ran away, but Manindra, I thought when I was hearing the story that Manindra might have just gone into his room and locked the door. But he said, no, he went after him. And he said, "Can I help you? Can I help you?" It looked like he needed help. I said, "Why did you do that?" And he said, "It looked like he needed help. You know, he was troubled." And so, you know, that kind of mind that just opens to everything, I don't know if he had any fear to look at in his own mind, but opens to everything and can respond with that connection of, can I help you? Loving kindness. Luckily, that person wasn't the kind of person that would harm someone else. We'd never heard about that in our neighborhood, but Manindra's heart was big enough to include this person too, this thief, so to say. He could see the world with quiet eyes, not be thrown off by those events. Spacious mind, that's how he was. And a lot of people in our lives were able to recognize their equanimity when we know it in ourselves more and more deeply. Equanimity goes beyond the extremes of fear, of hating, of criticizing, of insisting, of wanting it to be in a certain way. It goes beyond closing down in denial of it. A lot of times we feel that we're equanimous, but really we're just in denial of it, of what's going on. So these extremes are reactivity. They are the far enemy. And the far enemy is twofold. It's either aversion or any form of it or attachment. This is where the practice of mindfulness helps us to become familiar with those patterns that are deeply ingrained. It's like knowing the terrain of our minds and hearts so clearly, so intimately, that when it knows it's going towards aversion or towards attachment, we know the bumpiness of that. We know the stickiness of that. We know the quicksand of that. And we might have a chance before it falls into that extreme to rest the mind and to incline it even before it gets there to equanimity. One of the ways that equanimity is described is resting the mind before it falls into the extremes. Resting the mind before it falls into extremes. So we may not know, you know, what's around the corner, but we may sense it more and more clearly with our practice of vipassana. Sometimes, don't some of you who have practiced a long time know when a thought, maybe accompanied by aversion, is coming down the pike? Can't you feel that? I mean, it may be far off for some of you, but it's a possibility to feel like, oh, there's a thought of aversion. And right away, just knowing it, it can drop away and not have so much of an effect on the mind. That's when a lot of equanimity is there, when that kind of thing happens in your practice. When the mind is not in extremes and there is a spacious balance going on, it doesn't mean that nothing is happening inside. You could actually feel what's going on, but there's not, it's being felt within an atmosphere of equanimity, and the equanimity is stronger than that aversion or that attachment. So we connect with the equanimity a lot more strongly, a lot more clearly, as we know that pathway in our minds and in our hearts. Sometimes there's the usual ups and downs of life, sometimes subtle, intense, the praise and blame, gain and loss. But we're not clinging to the side of praise or gain or pleasure. Neither are we resisting or denying the blame, the loss, the pain. We're just with it. And there's really a deep sense of the strength of equanimity there. It's like looking at something going through the sky, and maybe it's not a pretty sight, but it's seen very, very clearly. But also the spaciousness of the sky is taken in and known also clearly. When that happens with experiences that go through the mind, it's sort of like, these words don't come with it, but it's sort of like this understanding that says, this too is part of life. Birth and death are part of life. this feeling of sorrow that goes by. That's part of life too. It's sort of making room for it, but not getting lost in it, not being carried away by it. A lot of loss has happened in our lives in the last years, few years. Close friends, family members, my mother, my teacher, my beloved cat, Feather, died. You've heard Feather stories a lot, those of you who know me. And so that refrain, you know, birth and death are part of life, gain and loss are part of life, come easily. These are teachings to us, possibilities of learning about ourselves more deeply, possibilities of developing equanimity more. There is a poignancy of love and wisdom when we say these refrains, these phrases. Birth and death are part of life. There's a lot of love in that. There's a lot of understanding and kindness. There's a lot of understanding that's wisdom, both kinds. The understanding that's kindness, the understanding that's wisdom. Manindra, who always used to say, surrender to the law, to the natural unfolding of life, he would say, as human beings, we have contact with pleasant and unpleasant. This is a fact of life. We have contact with both. No one is exempt from this. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya, the words of the Buddha. Develop a state of mind like the earth, for on the earth people throw clean and unclean things, dung and urine, spittle, pus, blood, and the earth is not repelled or disgusted. As you grow like the earth, no contact with pleasant or unpleasant things will lay hold of your mind or stick to it. Now, this doesn't mean that we have to be a doormat, you know, to all this. Equanimity doesn't mean you have to be a doormat to life. It just means that when it's already happened, we say, okay, this is how it is in this moment. If we can prevent it from happening, of course we do. We don't just say, okay, just run all over me. When we need to make a boundary, we make a boundary with kindness, with equanimity. I was in teaching once in Italy, and my girlfriend and I were together. She went with me. And we were at the train station in Florence, and she had bought something, and she said, I'll leave this here and please wait for me. And I stood there and waited for her. And then when she came, I left that package there. And somebody came and took it. So the person that came and took it was walking away. And then I all of a sudden remembered, oh, the package, my girlfriend's package. So I went towards that person. You know, I didn't just stand there and say, okay, this is how it's going right now. This person's walking away with our package. I went after that person, you know, and that what that person had was a package. She was holding a little girl's hand, and she had the package kind of hanging between their hands. And so I stopped the lady, and I said, this package is mine. And she said, no. No. And I said, oh no, this package is mine. And then she started saying, roba, roba, or something about, you know, robbing. And I said, oh no, 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 you roba, you know. So she was a little insistent, and I realized that I really had to take a little more action, just not the words. So gently I took their hands. And the little girl was just wondering. And I just took them apart, and then I took the package. And then they went off. You have to be careful in the train station. But I really wanted to make the point a visual, a story in your mind. You know, it's not just words that you let yourself be trampled on with equanimity, that you really take action, but you take action with clarity when you know that you're not going to hit the person or words that are going to come out that will hurt as well. So we've talked about the reactivity, the far enemy, and now the near enemy. It can seem similar, but it's not the same. Apathy, indifference, cold aloofness, callousness, emotional emptiness. These are all descriptions that meditators come up with to describe what is the feeling inside when you're not really connected. It seems like equanimity, balance, but there's no connection there. You feel actually closed down. You're not connecting with others, nor because you can't really connect with what's going on in your own heart. We may feel like, we can just walk away and not do anything from a place of equanimity, but really we're turning away from what's happening. There might be fear. There might be just an overwhelmness that we can't do anything about it. But it's not that at all. Equanimity is not apathy. It's not indifference. It's a real close connection to what's happening. One time when I was with Manindra in Sarnath, we went to visit a friend of his, and this friend was also a monk. There are not a lot of Indian monks, bhikkhus, in the Theravada tradition compared to like Thai or Burmese. So this was a very special monk. And we went to his monastery, and they were old friends, and they had such a good time meeting up with each other. They hadn't seen each other for years. Manindra had been this kind of the superintendent of the Theravada monasteries there at some point. And so they were old friends. Well, it came time to part. And we were walking out of his monastery. And they were holding hands, exchanging in their language. And then I was standing to the side and waiting for them to do what they needed to do to part. And then when Manindra turned around, he had tears in his eyes. And I said, Manindra, you have tears, you're crying. And he said, oh yes, he said, it's hard to part from those we love. But it wasn't like he was wailing or anything. But it was really a sense that he really felt that sorrow. He was just really open to it. He really let those tears fall. I would ask Manindra, where are you now on your path? Are you an arahant? And he would say, oh no, my path is not yet finished. And so, he wasn't so beyond all of that he didn't feel it. He totally felt it. And so this is the way we can feel all those emotions. But we don't have to kind of let them off-balance us in our lives. That was a very poignant time with him. So all these Dharma stories that give various metaphors from nature, from real life, mountains, rocks, space, people, can we allow ourselves that ability to notice clearly and honestly what's happening without getting lost in reactivity, without closing down in that kind of apathy? There are those three poisons, greed, hatred, and delusion. The far enemy of reactivity is greed and hatred. And the near enemy of apathy is really delusion. It represents delusion, that part of the three poisons. So what happens when we've already reacted inwardly? We've already done something out there and we felt like, oh, there's already this action or these words out there that have expressed my reactivity to what's going on. I think it's so wonderful that we have a second chance, you know, that it's not as though that's the end of our practice, that, okay, we've made a mistake and can't do anything about it. Because the next thing we can do is turn our attention, as we've been practicing in our sittings here, turn our attention to our own hearts and minds and notice that reactivity and develop equanimity around that. So we kind of, the chance to develop equanimity about the outer situation is already gone. I mean, we may have another chance, but we've already expressed something out of reactivity. But now we have a chance in that moment to turn towards here. What's going on here? Can we develop equanimity around the feeling that we have of aversion or dislike about that person, or annoyance about that person, or a strong wanting that it should be the way we think it should be? Can we look deeply? That's what we've been practicing here. I had a conversation with someone not too long ago when the conversation turned heated. This person was looking at a situation in one way, strongly taking her stand for this, that it should be this way. And I was trying to take a stand for this way that I saw it, and kind of, you know, wanting it to be in a certain way. And that kind of reactivity was coming out from my own mind. And then I noticed it come out and how it kind of ratcheted the whole conversation up to, you know, it's like I threw more logs into the fire. And, I realized my mistake at that moment. It kind of gave permission for more to happen. And so I just took a moment, staying as connected as I can, turn my attention to my own heart and notice that place in my own heart that wanted it to be in a certain way, you know, clinging to how I think it should be or how I saw a certain situation. Aversion to how she was taking her stance. Well, of course, I was just as strong. And then just brought some quietness to the situation. I think when we watch our own minds and hearts, nothing may be said, but that's a very powerful thing that happens among two people, where that there's a possibility for the other person to know that and to get entrained by that and to watch their own minds and hearts as well. Just a moment of quietness where you go introspective for a moment. And I finally had enough awareness to say, I think I'll stop talking now. But that took a lot for me to say for that person, and to say, I'm not coming from a clear space. And I wasn't. And to actually admit that. It stopped what was going on for a moment, but then, you know, the retort, yeah, it looks like you're not coming from a clear space. Oh, man, it took everything I could to get out the Dharma duct tape and just... That kind of disarmament is powerful. You know, it does have a powerful effect on our surroundings. So can we do that? We don't know. We're going to see. How can we open to the outer conditions of this world with equanimity and following on the heels of that compassion? How can we open to the inner conditions of this world here, which is really creating that world out there, or part and parcel of the creation, and know deeply what's happening here so that we can respond with some intelligence, so that we can connect compassionately, or sometimes not respond? I think more than half of the time, at least half of the time, it's better not to respond. You know, It only adds fuel to the fire, fanning the fire. So there's a vision that I hold, some of you have heard a few times already, that give me at least a memory of what it's like when I remember this vision of really holding, having my heart big enough and spacious enough to hold all that happens in this world and in my heart. And that was a time that I thought would be my last visit to my teacher, with my teacher Manindraji, who was in India at that time. And we had done a little traveling around, seeing the holy places. And this was our last day together in the town, the city of Varanasi. And as only a Dharma teacher would want for you, he wanted me to see dead bodies floating on the river, Ganges, because that would be a teaching of death, you know, seeing opening to death and the decomposition of a body and all of that. Well, we got in a boat before dawn, and we were going down the river. And we were close to the banks of the Ganges. And as you go in one direction, a particular direction, on one side of the Ganges are, to my right in this direction, were the burning ghats, where all the dead bodies were being burned. And it was a very clear and warm morning. On one side were those burning bodies that are close enough to see sometimes, you know, maybe as far as from here to the end of the building there. And then on the left side was the rising sun. So there was the birth of a new day, you know, in all its brilliance, and the death and decomposition, the decaying of a life, on the other hand. And so it's like looking here, looking there, you know, pleasant, unpleasant, birth and death. And with Manindra beside me, it was like, you know, just noticing what he's doing too, or feeling what his mind and his beingness go through, and just noticing all of life. You know, it's completely raw and in your face in India. Then there was on that side the burning ghats and all the wailing and sorrow from the families that were the relatives of the deceased person. And with me was my teacher and very good Dharma friends. So, you know, a lot of happiness for that I had next to me. And actually, to have a teacher is a great happiness. And then on the other side, to be able to hold that sadness. And just to hold, be able for my heart to say, yes, yes, this is part of life. The beauty and the sorrow, all of it, the pleasantness, the unpleasantness, the happiness and the good fortune to have someone guide me in my life, but then I may not ever see him again. You know, so that kind of sadness come up within me. To be able to open to it all takes a lot of equanimity. And when I can remember that time, then it's sort of like my heart can rest in that for a moment. It's not always like that. And there have been really hard times. But as I go along in my practice and I see others who have practiced equanimity and see their sort of success in being able to hold it all without reacting, so that if it's unpleasant, there's aversion. So that if it's pleasant, there's attachment. The response is intelligent. We know what to do instead of ways that come up that are unwholesome, and we lose our way. But we don't have to lose our way if we really keep the practice nearby. So I want to end with this poem actually by William Stafford, and the name of the poem is The Way It Is. It's actually from the book entitled The Way It Is. So William Stafford, as a teacher, says, there's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever lose the thread. So let's sit for a moment.